This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil. The Biden administration says it will evacuate about 2,500 Afghans who work for the U.S. government and their families to a military base in the U.S. state of Virginia, pending approval of their visas. The administration notified Congress on Monday that the Afghans will be temporarily housed at the Fort Lee Army Base south of the city of Richmond starting next week. The announcement comes amid growing concerns for the safety of the Afghans who served as translators and in other support roles for American troops and diplomats as the Biden administration rapidly withdraws U.S. forces from Afghanistan. The group to be housed at Fort Lee is just a small portion of the number of Afghans seeking refuge in the United States. The Biden administration is blaming China for a hack of Microsoft Exchange email server software that compromised tens of thousands of computers around the world earlier this year. The administration and allied nations on Monday also disclosed a broad range of other cyber threats from Beijing, including ransomware attacks from government-affiliated hackers that have targeted companies with demands for millions of dollars. A spokesperson for the Chinese embassy in Washington says a statement that the U.S. has repeatedly made groundless attacks and malicious smears against China on cybersecurity and calls the new allegations just another old trick. U.S. President Joe Biden tempered his assessment that social media giants are killing people by hosting misinformation about the COVID-19 vaccines on their platforms, saying that he hoped that they would not take it personally and instead would act to save lives. While companies like Facebook defend their practices and say they're helping people around the world access verified information about the shots, the White House says they haven't done enough to stop misinformation that has helped slow the pace of new vaccinations. This is VOA News. Canada is readying to reopen its side of the border. AP Washington correspondent Tim McGuire with details.
Canada's Health Minister, Patty Hajdu, tells CTV that the country will allow fully vaccinated U.S. citizens into the country starting August 9th and other fully vaccinated visitors on September 7th.
We intend to allow entry for fully vaccinated travelers from any country.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki was asked if the administration is working on plans to reopen the U.S. side of the northern border.
Any decisions about reopening travel will be guided by our public health and medical experts.
The U.S. Travel Association estimates that each month the border is closed to non-essential travel, it costs $1.5 billion. I'm Tim McGuire.
Haiti's Prime Minister Ariel Henry will replace the interim leader to honor the wishes of the country's slain president. More from AP correspondent Charles de la Desmond.
It's not immediately clear how quickly interim Prime Minister Claude Joseph, who's been leading Haiti with the backing of the police and the military since the July 7 assassination of President Jovenel Moïse, would step down. The change follows a statement on Saturday from a key group of international diplomats that appeared to snub Joseph, calling on Henri to form a government. Moïse designated Henri as Prime Minister a day before he was killed, but he had not been sworn in at that point. I'm Charles de la Desma.
A Tokyo court has handed down prison terms for the American father and son accused of helping Nissan's former chairman Carlos Ghosn escape to Lebanon while awaiting trial in Japan. Michael Taylor was sentenced to 2 years in prison. His son Peter was sentenced to 1 year, 8 months. They were charged with helping a criminal in the December 2019 escape of Ghosn. He hid in a box and was flown on a private jet via Turkey to Lebanon. Lebanon had no extradition treaty with Japan, and Ghosn, arrested in 2018 on financial misconduct charges, says that he is innocent. The Taylors did not fight the charges against them. Prince Harry, the Duke of Sussex, is writing what his publisher is calling an intimate and heartfelt memoir. The book, currently untitled, is expected to come out late 2022. The publisher Random House says that it will be the first time the Duke offers a definitive account of his life, including his service in Afghanistan, the joy he's found being a husband and father, and his adventures, losses, and life lessons that have helped shape him. The announcement comes 4 months after Harry and his wife Meghan, the Duchess of Sussex, made worldwide news during their interview with Oprah Winfrey. More at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte, Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 20th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ethiopian police reject claims of arbitrary Tigrayan arrests.
The police said they were supporting the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, which authorities banned after the Tigray conflict broke out in November. But rights groups Amnesty International says dozens were detained because of their ethnicity.
Security at a Uganda-South Sudan border crossing has been tightened. Tanzania's main opposition Chadema party says it will continue to meet with supporters despite harassment by the police. A Liberian editor says he fears a bounty has been placed on his head for exposing the ills of society. And Zambia's main opposition alliance is concerned that the August 12th presidential election may not be an even playing field.
The incumbent president, President Lungu, has gone about his business as usual, traversing the country at large, going to every place of his choice under the guise of him inspecting government projects.
And the 2019-2020 school year saw more Ghanaian students repeating grade levels because of COVID-19. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ethiopian police have confirmed the arrest of hundreds of ethnic Tigrayans in the capital Addis Ababa in recent weeks. The police said they were supporting the Tigray People's Liberation Front, the TPLF, which authorities banned after the Tigray conflict broke out in November. But rights group Amnesty International says dozens were detained because of their ethnicity. Galmo Dawit reports from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Addis Ababa Police Commissioner Getu Argao confirmed on Saturday that authorities had arrested over 300 Tigrayans. But speaking on the state-run Ethiopian Broadcast Corporation, Getu denied the Tigrayans were arrested because of their ethnicity. He said the arrests were made after thorough investigations found the suspects were supporting Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, which authorities banned other terrorist groups in May over the conflict in Tigray. He said their arrests targeted only individuals who were supporting the ousted terrorist group, the TPLF. So I want to assure that these arrests were not due to their ethnicity, said Getu. In addition to Tigrayans, we have also arrested suspects from other ethnic groups who were involved in supporting this terrorist group, he said, and we will continue to make such arrests in the future as well. Getu said illegal weapons and ammunition were seized from some of the suspects. He was responding to a call Friday by rights groups Amnesty International for Ethiopian authorities to end arbitrary detentions of Tigrayans without due process. Amnesty said the sweeping arrests appear to be ethnically motivated. The rights group said while some of the arrests were released on bail, while hundreds of others were still being detained and their relatives kept in the dark. Fasata Clay is Amnesty International's human rights researcher for Ethiopia. He tells VOA the families of those arrested do not know where they are being kept. They have not appeared in court, and this should stop. If they are involved in criminal activities, they should appear before court, says Fasaha, and the family should have the right to visit them, and they should get also an attorney. The arrests come as the war in Ethiopia's Tigray region appears to be expanding. A spokesman for the neighboring Afar region on Monday said Tigray fighters attacked Afar forces on Saturday and that clash continued over the weekend. The TPLF has also vowed to regain territory seized by Amhara forces loyal to the federal government. The conflict dates back to last November, when Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed deployed government forces to oust the TPLF from power in Tigray. Ethiopian authorities announced a unilateral ceasefire in Tigray on June 28 as Tigrayan forces retook the regional capital Mekele from federal troops. But with each passing day, it looks less likely the ceasefire is going to hold. Kelbudoit for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Zambia's main opposition United Party for National Development, the UPND Alliance, will hold a news conference today, Tuesday, to voice its concerns that there may not be an even playing field in the run-up to the August 12 presidential election. This after the opposition party condemned what it says is a continuing harassment of its presidential candidate, Hakainde Hichilema, by police. Supporters of the ruling Patriotic Front Party say the opposition leader has consistently violated electoral commission guidelines aimed at limiting the spread of the coronavirus during the campaign period. VOA's Peter Clottis spoke with UPND Alliance spokesperson Cornelius Muintwa about today's news conference.
The incumbent president, President Lungu, has gone about his business as usual, traversing the country at large, going to every place of his choice, under the guise of him inspecting government projects. Now, we have a situation where in some places there are no government projects whatsoever for him to inspect, such as marketplaces, which have nothing to do with an installation of a new project. But in the last 3 days, the UPND Alliance, you know, candidate Mr. Hakainde Hichilema ventured out in one of the suburb towns of Lusaka called Chongwe, where he was distributing COVID masks. And then the police did contact the legal team of the UPND, to which I am part of, and indicated that they had a call out to serve on our client, now speaking as part of the legal team.
But Cornelio, some people are expressing concern that it appears the UPND and your presidential candidate are flouting these measures implemented to ensure that the spread of the coronavirus is limited. Why wouldn't the UPND just follow the laid down regulations to ensure that your own supporters are protected to vote for you come August 12?
Well, of course, leadership is by way of leading by example. And presently, I have just indicated that President Edgar Lungu has been, during this same restrictions time of COVID restrictions, he has been to many towns, many provinces where he has gone, you know, to interact with the huge crowds of people. As you would imagine, they are throwing around a lot of party regalia and being thrown around, including by himself. Now, the question is, these COVID protocols or regulations, do they only apply to the opposition and they don't apply to the incumbent president?
The UPND is getting criticized for, you are inviting foreign powers to influence Zambians ahead of the elections. How do you respond to such criticism?
Well, that is very familiar with rogue states in Africa, with dictatorial states in Africa, with the states that have no regard whatsoever to the rule of law, with the states that do not want, you know, alumni or peer accountability, so that other countries, you know, take interest in what is happening. As you would imagine now, we live as a global village, and therefore we must be able to check on what your neighbor is doing so that we account for each and everyone's actions in this global village, because what happens in Zambia does not just affect Zambia, it affects the region, it affects the entire world.
Cornelius Muintwa is the spokesperson for the opposition UPND Alliance of Zambia. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. Security at the Eligot Uganda-South Sudan border crossing has been tightened as hundreds of South Sudanese try to force their way into Uganda looking for food. Ugandan security officials say they are overwhelmed by the numbers. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
For the past week, Ugandan authorities at the Ilegu border, which is located just across the Uganda-South Sudan border from the much larger city of Nimule, say they are battling to restrain entry of South Sudan nationals into the country. Officials say that they receive an average of 100 South Sudanese nationals walking to the border each day who want to cross into Uganda, but the borders remain closed to stem the spread of COVID-19. The South Sudanese nationals say they don't have enough to eat and want access to the relief food being supplied to refugees in the settlements. Most of those trying to forcefully overpower the guards, while others cross into Uganda at more porous borders. Scores of South Sudanese have entered Uganda as registered refugees, but have since moved back to their home country following the return of relative peace. Patrick Odong is the district health officer with the Amuru Border District.
The people who are stuck at the border are actually South Sudanese who were in South Sudan and have had that the distribution of items in the camps. So they want to enter back into Uganda and go and receive these items. But as you are all aware, the country is at lockdown. There is no inter-district travels. Then what of international travels? So it is something which can only be handled by the higher authorities.
As Uganda battles a deadly second wave of the COVID-19 pandemic, some Ugandan officials say they believe that allowing the South Sudan nationals into the country could worsen the situation. Ugandan Member of Parliament Norman Ochero wants security beefed up and increased surveillance along the border with neighboring countries, including South Sudan, to ensure that all those entering the country are COVID-free.
Right now, you can see, of course, many Sudanese intend to cross to Uganda, even without any test results. And this one increases give a very serious risk to citizens of Uganda. We are seeing a lot of struggles. So I think what I've observed is that the security needs to be a bit more serious, increase vigilance to ensure that people who are not tested don't enter into the country.
The Amuru district, where the Elegu border post is located, is one of the epicenters of COVID-19 infections in Uganda. Uganda has recorded 90,656 COVID-19 cases, with 2,392 deaths. Only Ugandans with negative COVID-19 certificates are allowed back into the country. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 20th. In Tanzania, leaders of the main opposition Chadema Party say they will continue to meet with their supporters despite intimidation and harassment by the police. Party officials say more than 100 supporters were arrested during a party meeting over the weekend to discuss a new constitution. Supporters of the ruling Chama cha Mapinduzi Party say the arrest was necessary because the meeting was a super spreader. John Mreman is Chadema's Director of Communication, Foreign Affairs, and Protocols. He tells viewers Peter Clotier that party leaders will decide tomorrow, Wednesday, whether to continue to meet supporters across the country.
We are holding internal meeting on constitutional reform. We are expecting more than 600 people to attend in Mwanza. We've already done the same in Dar es Salaam 1 week ago. And the day before yesterday, we were supposed to do it in Mwanza. But in the morning, the day of the event, the police went to our venue, and then they told everybody to vacate because it was an illegal meeting. While under all our political parties' laws, internal meetings, we should not even invite police or tell them that we are holding an internal meeting. What we are supposed to tell them is when you want to do a public rally. That's where you have to give them a notice of 24 hours. But for internal meeting, police, they have no any power to do anything about that. So they arrested more than 128 people, and they arrested them for 30 hours. And then yesterday, after we have told them that we are not standing for bail for them, they released them without any bail, any condition. And this proves that they arrested them illegally.
Does that mean that your meeting that you have scheduled for Wednesday in Mwanza will proceed as originally planned, despite what Mbowe said, it's harassment by the police?
That is the decision that we are going to hold it on Wednesday, and Mr. Mbowe is going to lead it. He will be in the front, and has already told the police and the public that if they want to arrest him, they better arrest him because we are tired now. We don't want to go back to the Magufuli regime anymore. And we have told the members from the media, they should support us because they remember where they were for the last 5 years. We should not allow that. And Mr. Mbowe has already said, never and never again going back to Magufulism.
If your party decides with your leader, Freeman Mbowe, to go ahead with subsequent meetings of Chadema,
Are you not going to put your supporters' life in danger by one, with the coronavirus spreading in Tanzania, and two, clashing possibly with the police?
All our internal meetings, we always observe coronavirus protocols. We do give them masks, all of them, sanitizers when they get in and when they get out. So as a party, we do all the precautions on the coronavirus. But on the case of the police harassment, that they have harassed us for the last 5 years. And we thought President Samia Suluhu, she's going to end this harassment from the police. But we are now seeing that we are going back where we were the last 5 years. We are not ready to see it again. We know Tanzanians, they need a new constitution.
John Rayman is the Director of Communication, Foreign Affairs and Protocols for the Chadema Opposition Party of Tanzania. You are speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. In Liberia, the editor-in-chief and publisher of the country's front-page Africa newspaper says he fears a bounty has been placed on his head for exposing the ills of society. In a chilling letter from the editor, Rodney Sie wrote, "The last few days have been among the most challenging of my journalistic life." Sie's paper has faced many adversities from successive Liberian governments for its reportage, including imprisonment and closure. He said the latest threat is coming from some members of the main opposition alliance, the collaborating political parties, the CPP. Rodney Sears said the threats began when his paper published an investigative article that notable progressive opposition senator Abraham Darius Delon flew first class during his recent travel to the United States and not economy class, as the senator had posted on his Facebook page.
The last week, we've been able to pick up the fact that a senator, Senator Abraham Darius Delon, flew business class on Delta Airlines to the United States of America and posted a photograph on his Facebook page. Amid the backlash in the public, he came out and denied the fact that he flew business class. He claimed that he had gone to the business class to talk to some friends. When we dug up the story and found out that he actually flew business class, his supporters began issuing threats to us on social media. And then another politician, Benai Yure, the former head of the coalition of political parties, went on the rampage to various newspapers and sought to write or post articles against me and my newspaper. And one of the editors he spoke to sent us text message he shared with this editor suggesting that he would use money to go after me. So that's the basis for me suggesting that this has been a very challenging week for me.
In your letter, you said that some officials of the opposition collaborating political parties have in the last 42 to 72 hours been planting stories with other local news outlets, some referring to you as paid to play. Is this really true?
Well, apparently, the former leader of the opposition, CPP, Coalition for Political Parties, Mr. Yuri, was unhappy with the article we published, because he's a former ally of former President Charles Taylor. And we were raising issues about his association with the former Vice President Joseph Boakai. Apparently, he's unhappy about it, and he took the route of suggesting that we were being paid by another opposition politician, Mr. Alexander Cummins, head of the Alternative National Congress, to write against him, Mr. Yuri. So I think he felt that the article was unfair to him, but the route he took was to go after us by planting stories in other newspapers and threatening that he would use his money to destroy us.
I asked that question because one of the banes of journalism in many African countries is the lack of editorial independence, because most often the powers that be are constantly bribing journalists. Does your paper receive money from opposition and government officials to publish favorable stories for them?
It's a practice in a lot of African countries, James, but our newspaper try our best. And in fact, we have a zero tolerance policy in our paper regarding receiving money to publish articles. A lot of times people call me and ask me, how much would you charge to publish a story? And I tell them, we only charge for advertisement. We do not charge for stories. But you know, the challenges in Africa is difficult. So sometimes we have problems where an individual reporter would do that. And we have fired one or two reporters for doing that. So our policy is very tight and strict about that. We do not accept money for stories.
What do you think this means in terms of your paper continuing to do the good reporting that it has done over the years?
For me, James, I think it shows that we are doing a good job. I think that it shows that we are unrelenting in our pursuit of the truth. We are unrelenting in our pursuit of being objective and unbiased. And we continue to tell people that we have no malice against anyone. We have no vendetta against anyone. We're only doing the job of reporting the news. It may not be pleasing to the ears of some of those we cover, but we strive to do the best we can all the time.
Rodney, thank you so much. It's so nice to talk with you.
Thank you, James. I appreciate it.
That was Rodney Sear, editor-in-chief and publisher of Liberia's front page Africa newspaper, speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. As you heard in the interview, Mr. Sear made reference to Mr. Benoni Ure, but when contacted, Mr. Ure declined to comment on the allegations, except that he wants Liberia to move forward. While the school dropout rate in Ghana was not as high because of the COVID-19 pandemic, the 2019-2020 school year did see more students repeating grade levels, according to a new study by the Ghanaian think tank Institute for Educational Planning and Administration. Mike Abret, a researcher and author of the study, spoke to Ricky Stryak about how the pandemic affected education in the country.
Beyond what we know from our data, there are a number of variables that could possibly explain the situation we saw. Included in this are published and unpublished pieces of evidence. And so in the situation we know in country in Ghana, there is a number of data sets that inform us that there are a number of policies implemented by government that had the natural effects. Across Africa, in the bigger part of 2020, I think the picture we got across Africa, Ghana had one of the most responsive approaches to responding to COVID containment on the continent. And so that might be a possible reason. We also had other studies indicating the trust people had in the system that going back to school was going to be safe, because we had a situation in one of the girls' schools in the Greater Accra region. In that particular situation, we had a spike in the number of COVID cases, but government rushed to the scene and contained the situation, further giving confidence in the public that schools reopening generally was going to be good.
You did find, though, that more students were repeating grades. Why do you think that is?
The situation, again, is not unique to Ghana. We found the same situation in Malawi, found the same situation in Senegal. We think there is more we can empirically investigate beyond what we found. What we know are about three issues. Overrate incidences are already rife, and in the midst of COVID, other research and data indicated that there were incidences of pregnancy among kids, and that required that others leave school and all that. Those could form the reasons for some of the repetition. And indeed, there could also be a situation that we saw in our data set, wherefore the situation in urban and rural, as well as the rich and the poor, was showing some differentials in terms of repetition. There were high proportions of people in the rural setting who were actually repeating compared to their urban folks.
You touched on this a bit, but how did economic difficulties from the pandemic affect education?
When schools reopened, quite a amount of weeks had to be spent on remediating learning in the grade before. Note, in Ghana, there was a mass promotion of all kids. Much as all the kids were promoted to the next higher grade, there needed to be some intervention to support them to be able to run, which means that already the COVID-19-induced school closures might have affected learning. Also, teachers needed to do things differently because they had to face new policies about schooling and how they were going to manage the kids in school. But more practically, we had interesting data sets from our study that shows quite interesting situation. We realized about 86% of schools who were early child centers, mostly private, were not paying their staff during school closures. This could have impacted on this livelihood of these teachers and, for that matter, education overall.
That was Mike Abre, a senior researcher with the Ghanaian think tank Institute for Educational Planning and Administration. You are speaking to Ricky Stryak from Cape Coast, Ghana. And that's it for this Tuesday, July 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Shryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Button, Washington, wishing you a very good day.